Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and at this time we begin the TechNet, as we do most Sunday evenings for the last 35 and a half years. The major purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious amateurs get together and literally teach each other how wireless equipment works and how to make it work better and how to understand it. Transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, antennas, propagation, the 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, and we discuss many of those. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment for the net. Need that sign in just because you're listening. After 35 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. Let me drop. Sorry. The last 10 years or 11 years of the TechNet are recorded, and you can play them back by going to the KC2NJI website, which is called amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. There you can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and play back past 10 minutes. Quite a few of those years are even cross-referenced. There's another website. That was Mike number one. Mike number two is another supporting website by K1MJM, and that is TechNetLimeArc.com. LimeArcTechNet.com. And both of these you'll find pictures, articles, and supporting hardware, supporting information with reference to the TechNet.
Repeater.
Each time it's your turn to transmit to the TechNet, try to remember to wait for all four beeps. Some people get very excited, squeeze the mic real fast before the four beeps. The machine does not get a chance to fully reset. It times out, and therefore a portion of what they said doesn't get heard. So try to remember to wait for the four beeps. Okay, this time we're going to take check-ins. You're going to give me your, if you do have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2IW listening. Now maybe we're not going to have any questions tonight. Maybe it's going to be a very short TechNet. We do have a couple of people going who in the last couple of weeks are going to go out and make some further measurements and report back to us. Hopefully they'll be showing up tonight to tell us what they discovered. And when it comes to the space report, Paul WS2N will be telling us what happened on Friday as the Cassini spacecraft committed suicide by diving into Saturn to end its life after a 10-year mission. Or was it a 20-year mission? I think it's 20 years altogether, but 10 years at Saturn itself, taking hundreds of thousands of pictures, some very exciting pictures. So Paul will be describing that to us. So, do we have anyone to check in with a question or a comment tonight? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2IW listening.
Handheld.
Okay, I heard the word handheld. Please give me your call letters and name, sir.
JRC on handheld. I can't hear the four beeps because my radio doesn't let me listen and transmit at the same time. My name is Michael, and checking in.
Okay, Michael. I think you told me your call letters are Juliet, Romeo, Charlie, and I missed the prefix. Go ahead, Michael.
It's Kilo Delta 2 Juliet Romeo Tango.
Okay, Juliet Romeo Tango, Kilo Delta 2. We got you, Michael. Anyone else to check in, please give me your call letters and name right now.
Harry.
K2EJ.
Eric, K2EJ. Alrighty, let's see who else we have to check in. We've got...
Repeater, timeout.
Harry.
K2EJ.
Barry.
Okay, I think I heard Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Golf Charlie. Is that true? And if so, please give me your name.
This is Big Barry.
It's Kilo Delta 2 Hotel Uniform Charlie. Steve.
Okay, that time we got you, Steve. Kilo Delta 2 HUC. And maybe you're going to be reporting some of the information you were gathering over the last 2 weeks. So far we've got Mike, Eric, and Steve. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Please give me the call letters right now.
NWS2N is here. Good evening, Dick. Name's Paul, and we're here with the space report, like you said before.
Very fine, Paul. WS2N. One last call. Anyone to check in, because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Please give me a call letters right now. Okay, we're going to go to Mike first. Kilo Delta 2, Juliet Romeo Tango. Go right ahead, Mike. K2LAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Harry, go ahead. It's all you.
CJRT. Hi. I've been in the last 2 years, but I've been inactive for a while, and I only started getting back into it and, you know, actually learning how, you know, ham radio works. I recently was able to move back to New York City and figured out how to actually set an antenna in such a way I can hit this repeater from, I'm basically at the base of the Queensboro Bridge right now. I can't hit it from the apartment. What I'm trying to learn right now is the basics of building an antenna. I'm interested in building a 2-meter Yaki tape measure antenna, but I don't really have any tools or skills for doing any sort of construction like this, so I was hoping to find if anyone had, you know, hints or, like, know the location, like a workshop where I could rent and, you know, try and build this and possibly fail miserably. And I also need to find some of an antenna tuner to be able to check the SWR on it. KD2JRT, over.
As I see it, Mike, if you're following a well-respected design for an antenna, like a dipole, maybe they suggest you use 14-gauge household wire, X number of feet long, or a ground plane antenna made out of a SO239 connector, and they tell you how long to make each of the 19-inch long approximately wires on the four sides and tilt it down at a 45-degree angle. What I'm getting at is if you're taking a classic antenna design and following it, it doesn't take any tools. As long as you've got the soldering iron to put it together, so to speak, you really have to test the standing wave ratio. You really have to know what the exact number is. And the answer might be no. A handy talkie, for instance, is amazingly forgiving. If you're feeding a piece of transmission line into that antenna from a handy talkie or almost any other kind of rig, I'd say, for instance, VHF frequencies like 2 meters. Let me drop it. An awful lot of the checking that you think is required is not required. If at worst, because of metallic objects too far, too close nearby, interfering with the cadence of the antenna a little bit, if the antenna, instead of giving you a 1.2-to-1 standing wave ratio, it gave you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Almost all VHF rigs are amazingly forgiving. Even if the antenna had an extremely high standing wave ratio, your rig is not going to suddenly burn up, if you know what I mean. It's not going to have any failures. They're very rugged these days. So simply building the antenna and using it puts you on the air. The testing of the antenna is more for academic reasons. If you're following some respected design, it'll work. And when it comes to an antenna, in many cases you've got the choice of buying a very expensive antenna and mounting it down low, or building a coat hanger wire antenna and mounting it up high. 98% of the time you get a hell of a lot more performance out of the yucky looking antenna that's up high. On VHF frequencies, altitude is everything. So anything you can do to put it up high, even a high altitude within the apartment, or if you can get it onto the roof of your New York City building, that would be very helpful. So you think you have a need for making measurements of the antenna, and an antenna tuner on VHF frequencies is almost never required. On HF frequencies, yes, it's nice to have an antenna tuner, but even if you start off without one, you're still on the air. KD2 JRT KRT, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mike.
JRT. That's good to know. I mean, I've been trying to get back into ham radio, and it's just been a little bit difficult because I'm having trouble understanding a lot of it. I'm working to upgrade my license plate class to general at the ham fest coming up. But that helps. I mean, I don't currently have any soldering iron or any equipment, but I guess I can buy some. I just still need to find an area where I can do it because I can't solder where I'm currently living for complicated reasons. Part of why I want to build a Yagi is to try and punch out from New York. I do have roof access, although I can't install anything permanent up there. And with my whip and tent and a baking dish, I can reach Long Island, New Jersey, but more than that. And the directional antenna seems like it would actually help a considerable deal. I guess on top of that, I'm also looking to make sometime do... low Earth orbit operations. Although I just have a little Baofeng radio now. It's worked quite well for me, but I need to start somewhere, and building an antenna seems like a good place to go. KRT, over.
You've got it right on that point, Mike. When it comes to home brewing, the antenna is where amateurs really shine. Modern day 80 to 10 meter single sideband transceivers or a 2 meter FM or sideband transceiver, essentially nobody builds that piece of equipment today. 30 years ago, yes, home brewing of the transmitter and receiver was required. But nowadays, there are so many brand names at such a ridiculously cheap prices as far as the number of man hours you'd have to put into it to home brew it. You could spend a year of your life building a transceiver, or you can buy it with a week and a half or 2 weeks worth of salary, and you buy it with 2 weeks worth of salary, and you buy a good brand name and a good model number that's well respected, and a year later, if you don't like it, you can sell it and get 80% of your money back, if you know what I mean. Whereas you build a homebrew rig, you're going to own it for the rest of your life. Almost nobody's going to buy it from you, and it takes a lot more effort. So building the transmitter and the receiver, except for microwave frequencies, is no longer done. But the antenna, yes. In many cases, the raw material that goes into an antenna are not very expensive. On top of that, the labor required is not very bad. I have built antennas in the bedroom of the apartment I was living in when I first got into ham radio. Let me drop it. And if some of the information seems kind of foreign to you, spooky, hard to understand, as a brand new ham radio operator, you're in good company. We all start off that way. I got my license by memorizing all the questions for the exam, the written portion of the exam. I was memorizing what is a watt, what is an ampere, and what is a joule. And I didn't have the vaguest idea what those words meant in the beginning. I just simply memorized those questions so I knew how to give the right kind of an answer. Many of us start off that way. Now, when it comes to homebrewing antennas, if, for instance, it's a VHF Yagi you would like to build so that from your apartment in New York City you can aim the antenna at a good direction and pick up a particular repeater that may be a long distance away, let me suggest a website to you. Let me drop it. If you go to the website of Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, Kent, Britain, in the Dallas area of Texas. At that website, on the first couple of pages, you'll see his printed circuit VHF antennas that he sells. But if you go to the further pages of his website, he has a whole bunch of articles on very easy to build coat hanger wire Yagi antennas with a boom made out of a slat of wood and coat hanger wire cut up to the right length. Very easy to follow designs. Very high performance Yagis. You know, they've got the $2 worth of material in there and they act almost as good as a $150 antenna you can buy commercially. So Angeles, WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Julian Bravo. Go to that website and find the second, third or page where he's got his so-called cheap Yagis made out of coat hanger wire. Boy, you can get a lot of performance out of those for the money. You don't need testing equipment to build that kind of antenna. You just follow the recipe and you get 98% of the performance that you want to get using no test equipment. So that's one of the many ways you can do it. Many other guys will decide that they want to vertically polarize. By the way, those Yagis, if you tilt it 90 degrees with reference to the horizon in polarization, you can make a vertically polarized Yagi. Or mounting it parallel to the ground, you can make it a horizontally polarized Yagi and talk to the sideband people. The sideband people primarily use horizontal polarization, while the FM people primarily use vertical polarization. Let me drop it. And if your antenna is mounted on a mast, with a rotator, we'll say, on the roof of the building, and it's horizontally polarized because you set it up to talk to the sideband people, and therefore you think you can't talk to the vertically polarized FM people, absolutely you can. Even though it's cross-polarized, you'd be amazed how well the signal still gets there. At a little bit of a disadvantage. The antenna you're listening to right now that I'm using is tilted in polarization at a 45-degree angle, halfway between horizontal and vertical. That makes me a couple of dB weaker to each of those horizontal and vertical people, but I can talk to both of them with the same Yagi antenna that's mounted on my rotator on the top of the tower. So, and sometimes guys will also go to another website on the internet, and you look up the word J-pole, J-pole. That's another kind of antenna that's very easy to homebrew. A J-pole, vertically polarized, 2 meter or 440 antenna, which can be made out of very convenient materials. So you follow one of those recipes, and you'll get a lot of bang for the dollar. If you need a repeat on any of that, Mike, go right ahead. Kilo Delta 2, Juliet Romeo Tango, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I have a J-pole. It's a commercial one I picked up when I got my deck, but used the antenna in the car. I did not trust the ability to homebrew something that could survive interstate speeds. The J-pole works really well. I mean, because I don't have line of sight on this repeater, but as long as I'm outside, I can hit it, and I've been told that my voice quality is pretty good. I'm about 10 miles out from the repeater on the handheld. So I'm hoping with a direct Yagi versus the J-pole, it will successfully punch through, and I'll be able to work much farther stations. It's about 10, assuming ideal conditions, about 20 miles at 5 watts is my current max, but I want to see if I can get that any higher. Also, if I want to try and do second operation, a directional antenna is typically easier to hit a satellite, especially SO-52, than the J-pole, unless I dump a whole lot of power into it. I remember to release the button every once in a while. Apologies. Those resources, and hopefully next week I'll have some interesting successes to report, or I'm using stories of failure. K2JRT, over.
Kilo Delta 2, Juliet Romeo Tango, K2RW. Yeah, Mike, once you build yourself a vertically polarized Yagi, and maybe you're going to build the one that I mentioned, the A5VJB coat hanger wire Yagi antenna, they've got something like a 45 degree beam width. You can sort of aim it like a flashlight, so to speak, mount it on top of a boom handle, and aim it out the window of your apartment. What you'll probably discover is that particular repeaters, when you're in the marble canyons of New York City, if you aim the Yagi directly at the repeater, or in some cases you aim it at a particular building that gives you a favorable reflection, a bounced signal, you'd be amazed at what angles you'll get a significant increase in the signal strength to and from that repeater. So to have an aimable Yagi antenna is a nice way to go. Lots of people don't want to have the ability to aim the antenna. They just want to the antenna to be omnidirectional all the time and don't worry about aiming it. And that works for convenience, but you can get a lot more. You can get two or three times the range with the Yagi, which takes whatever power you've got. And the gain of the antenna squirts the signal like a flashlight beam at the particular repeater, making the signal a lot stronger in both transmission and reception in that direction. So it's a good thing to experiment with. You'll like it. And so come back next week and let us know how well this experiment goes. And in the case of an apartment in New York City, as long as you put down the right kind of protective material on the table, there's nothing to stop you from doing soldering, construction, sawing, and whatever. I've done some good antenna work, so to speak.
Repeater, time out.
In fact,
the yes of the comment.
Rich recognized quite a bit of the construction of the transmitter, the 432 transmitter, the parallel kilowatt amplifier, was done in the second bedroom of the house where I was living in at the time, the apartment building. And a guy who does a lot of antenna homebrewing is Rich. We're going to hear from him right now. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, probably in Pennsylvania. Mobile, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick. K2UPS Mobile. No, I'm still in Ohio, near Quaker City, but heading back to New York. And my suggested to Mike is between the five boroughs, Long Island, New Jersey, there's got to be at least two dozen ham clubs within about a 25-mile radius or so from where he is. Some are more active than others, but I would suggest that he start seeking them out. Try to go. You can get a list of some of them on the AWRL website. If they're linked in with the league, they'll give you the address. You type in your zip code, it'll tell you the different clubs, contact information, sometimes even when they meet is there. But go down, meet other hands. You'll be able to borrow tools, you know, you use some stuff there. They'll help you with the construction of different things. And you know, you'll make a lot of contacts that way, which will be very helpful, I think, for you in your future with ham radio. Back to that.
That's a very good suggestion, Rich. The director for Long Island of ARRL publishes a monthly newsletter telling you what's going on. But at the end of that newsletter, he lists essentially every one of the clubs in the area, tells you what day of the week, like this club meets on the second Tuesday, and this club meets on the first Wednesday, and so on. And what's the address where they meet, what's the hour where they meet, what repeater are they associated with. So if you can get a hold of the monthly newsletter from ARRL for the Long Island area, tremendous amount of information is there. I'm not sure whether or not you've got to be an ARRL member in order to have access to that newsletter. There's probably a way you can get access to it as a person who hasn't joined the ARRL yet, but that's a good suggestion. To pick the brains of a fellow club member and go to some of their meetings is a good way to get a lot of information in a hurry. That's another very good suggestion, Rich. Let's see if Mike's got any further requests for fills on any of the information he just heard. KD2JRT, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mike.
I'm definitely interested in getting back into the clubs. I was a member up in Rochester, but I didn't have the best experience, but I was going to try and go out to the Bergen County Club, and then October 6th or 7th, I don't have the date in front of me. So, I'll take a look and see what's going on in Long Island and see what I can swing. I've got some personal issues that make it difficult for me to travel and make those sort of things, but I'm going to do what I can and see what I can. Hold on, dropping. Back. Definitely want to see what I can manage and, you know, do. I'm pretty happy just going up to the park, setting up my little J-pole, and hitting the repeater. I can hit this repeater, I can hit W2, Alpha Bravo Charlie, and the one on Rockefeller. So I can get pretty in conversations. I can hit the former two, those last two from my apartment. It's just this one I can't hit. So, it's a lot better than, the usual case of can't hit repeater, dead repeaters. So anyway, thanks all for your help. I'll stay on net for a while and comment if I can. KDCJRT out. Over.
Pretty fine, Mike. Once you do build yourself a 2-meter Yagi, maybe out of coat hanger wire, and you find the right place to aim it, even from your apartment in New York City, I think there's a 50-50 chance that you'll get to this repeater, even though you haven't been successful up till now. The extra directivity and aiming it in the right direction is going to make a great big difference. So it's worth a try. The price is right. Eric was the next person on our list, KE2EJ. You're supposed to be supplying us information, not asking questions, Eric. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW. You got it, Eric. I'm pretty sure Eric did sign in. Give him another call. Kilo Echo 2, Echo Juliet, KE2EJ. K2RIW, go right ahead, Eric.
Sorry about that. I'm in the middle of things. K2RIW, K2EJ. I'll tell you what, why don't you take the next person and then come back to me, because I think I'm going to dive deep into something. So, let me turn it back to you.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Sounds like he's going to get real technical. No, we don't get that technical on a TechNet, Eric. That's a joke. Okay, Steve is next. KD2HUC. What have you been up to, Steve? K2RIW and the TechNet?
Hey, good evening, Dick. I've been busy. Last we left off, I was having issues with my DXCC. It's a fan dipole. And, after our conversation, it was a good time to start talking, to look in a different direction. So I took it apart. Let me let it drop. And the ballon that I was using looked like it needed some love and attention, so I just replaced it. And I put it back at the same height, tuned it up a little bit on 20, and lo and behold, I got an SWR down to 1.7, which was more than, happy for me. And I actually started getting out. I made my first DX contact across the Atlantic. I was very excited about that. Let me let it drop. 80 was still giving me a hard time. So after our conversation regarding height, I raised the antenna. Now, this had a couple of repercussions, I should say. One, I had to add 30 additional feet of feed line in order to get up to the new height. It's now about 60 feet up in the air. And number two, the SWRs and the impedances seem to have shifted. And I don't really know, I can tune the 20 again. That's not a problem. But last we were talking about putting capacitors and whatnot, I forgot to mention that this is a trap dipole. The 40 and 80 have traps in it. It's a single element with traps. So I wanted to know a little more about how to tune that. I did get my hands on an antenna analyzer. So I have it set up, and anything you can guide me through, I can give you real numbers right now as I'm talking to you. KD2HUC, back to net.
So if I understand correctly, it's a trap dipole, and it's an 80 and 40 and 20 at least, I think, if I understand correctly. And I presume as you tune across 80, tune across 40, tune across 20, if this is the best of all worlds, and you plotted standing wave ratio at each one of the frequencies, like on 40 meters, you might tune to 7.1, 7.2, 7.3, and so on, and plot the standing wave ratio. If everything was great, you get a bathtub-shaped curve, a U-shaped curve, with the bottom of U-shaped curve, the lowest standing wave ratio is at your favorite frequency. And if the antenna is tuned high or low, then the bottom of that bathtub curve is in a particular direction. So hopefully you've done that kind of testing to find out which one of your bands is tuned high, low, or just right on the money. And if your standing wave ratio at your favorite frequency is something like 1.5 to 1, you could make it lower than that for academic reasons if you wanted to. Let me drop. But you really don't have to. Yes, some rigs are kind of persnickety, and beyond 1.5 standing wave ratio, the self-protect circuit will start cutting back in power output. Some rigs are like that. But it's only the rig that's sensitive. It's not the antenna or the interface between the rig and the antenna that matters, because the average guy would be horrified by having a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Believe it or not, as long as the transmitter is happy, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio never loses you more than 0.5 dB of transmitted power. Never more than 0.5 dB for a 2-to-1. And 0.5 dB of real loss, real apparent loss, is 1/12 of an S unit of a well-calibrated signal strength meter on the receiver. So there are guys who think that the antenna is going to explode if they don't get it down to a 1.1 standing wave ratio. You can spend your time doing that for academic reasons if it gives you pleasure, but for electronic reasons it's not really required. So which bands are giving you what kind of response at which end of the band, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, let me describe the antenna first so you have a good understanding. It is a fan dipole with traps for 40 and 80. So basically you have a separate element for 10, you have a separate element for 20, and then you have the 40 and 80 element with traps in it, you know, to between the 40 and 80. 80 is the one that seems to be giving me the most heartburn. As I'm sitting here, I have the antenna analyzer is set to 3.75, and I'm getting an 11.7 SWR. So if I was having 2-to-1, I'd be excited. The 11.2 or 11.4-to-1 that it, you know, it's bouncing back and forth on leaves a little bit to be desired. Back to you.
Okay, 11.7 on 3.75 megacycles. Out of curiosity, since it's a trap dipole on 80 and 40, what is it doing on 40, Steve? Go ahead.
40 is not terrible. 40 looks like, ever since I raised it, and by raising it, it also changed the angle between the legs. It isn't, you know, it's an inverted V, so the angle slightly changed between the legs. But, and it only shifted, I was getting like 1.5 to 1, but slightly below 7 megahertz. So that's not terrible. I mean, all I need to do is make that a little longer, shorter rather, and that should just come right into band. But now, what do I do with the 80, with these coils?
Yeah, 11.7 or 11.5 standing wave ratio on 80 meters, without a doubt, is alarming. Something is dead wrong. In the very beginning, or at any time in the past, did it give you a lower standing wave ratio? Is this a sudden change that occurred, maybe because of a mechanical failure? So did the antenna, the trap dipole, fan dipole, did it ever give you a reasonable standing wave ratio on 80 meters? Back to you, Steve.
WB2HWW with a comment and a question on that, Dick.
Yeah, the answer is no, Dick. Ever since this antenna came out of the bag, 80 has always been a problem. And after trying to narrow it down, I finally settled on the fact that maybe the issue was the height, you know, that it was too close to the ground. So now it's up in the air. It's better, but it's not where I want it to be.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of questions, but I'm going to go over to Howie first. WB2HWW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Howie.
Okay, Dick, I do want to ask a question first before I give a comment. Did he sweep up and down the band, or does he find any place where it's working? That's the first thing. If he doesn't, I think it would be the trap, because the trap on the there may be a problem with the trap because the trap should act as an open circuit when you're on 40 meters. So that's what it should be. Maybe there's a problem with the trap. That's the only thing you can think of. If you went up there and jumped a wire around the trap, would you get a better SWR? That's one way to check on either side. The trap should be an open circuit on 40 meters. Go ahead, Dick.
The fact that he's getting a 1.5 standing wave ratio on 40 meters suggests that at least on that band the trap is working. If you had a complete failure of the trap, you'd have terrible standing wave ratio on 40 meters too. Now, you may also have a false alarm here, Steve, with reference to altitude. If a fan dipole is designed to operate at, say, 40 feet, and if it's working correctly and gives you a 1.3 standing wave ratio in 80 meters, and you don't mount it at 40 feet, you mount it at 20 feet instead, your 1.3 standing wave ratio might go to 1.5. But that's not going to cause you to get a sudden 11-to-1. So altitude and the 11-to-1, in my opinion, Steve, are thoroughly unrelated. You can't blame that on altitude. And when it comes to the inverted V, where the antenna was designed to be straight out, so to speak, and you're using that an inverted V, and the ends of your elements come closer to the ground. Closer to the ground means 5 feet up or greater. Now, that's going to make the 1.4 go to a 1.7 standing wave ratio, but that's not going to give you 11-to-1. You can only get an 11-to-1 if the tips of the dipole are touching the ground, if you know what I mean, or wrapped around a tree limb. So there's something very wrong. That's an alarming standing wave ratio. Something is really an open circuit or a short circuit, so to speak. I think you said you did. Let me drop it. I think you said you modified or you replaced the ballon, and maybe the ballon looks like it had been cooked, because maybe you were putting 200 watts into it, key down for a long period of time into a high standing wave ratio, 11-to-1 standing wave ratio, with a lot of power put into it with a good antenna tuner, can certainly overheat a ballon. So, Howie might be on the right track there. When you give a visual inspection to that trap element, the manufacturer probably told you what it should look like with his photograph or his schematic diagram. And is there an open circuit, a short circuit? Is there is there something mechanically that you can see that's wrong with that trap? So right now, you're looking for a complete failure of something to give you that 11.7. That's not altitude. And out of curiosity, when you're at the low end or the high end of 80 meters, is it different? When it's 11.7, I suspect it's going to be reasonably bad across the hold-on band. KD2HUC, K2LIW, you got it, Steve.
It is reasonably bad across the band. It does get better as the band goes up. I did inspect the traps. They look brand new. Not even so much as corrosion on them. No blast marks, no burns, nothing that looks like any type of a short or an open. It looks clean as can be. I can take it down and do a continuity test on it, I mean, just to make sure. But I'm imagining if there was enough power to damage that coil, and it's pretty stout, it's made with, looks like number 14 wire. So I doubt I was, I've never driven anything that hard into 80 because the standing wave ratio has been nuts. So, let me let it drop. I have an antenna analyzer hooked up to this thing right now in front of me as I'm sitting talking to you. I have very limited knowledge on how this, how to properly utilize this piece of equipment. So maybe there's something with it that can help me head in the right direction. Back to you.
Yeah, it sounds like you've given the traps a good visual inspection and you see nothing suspicious. If I understand you correctly, you did see something suspicious with the ballast. Like maybe it looked cooked, and you replaced the ballast. There's another failure mechanism the trap could have. It could look perfectly all right, but the capacitor could be giving you the wrong rating. The capacitor may be internally is failed, acting as an open circuit or a short circuit. So the trap itself, if you find the right website where people give you further information, and maybe the manufacturer tells you, the trap itself should have a particular resonant frequency. And by way of a grid dip meter, a grid dip oscillator, you could measure the resonant frequency and therefore electronically confirm that each of the two traps is doing the right thing. All you need is one of the traps to fail. That could give you a ridiculously high standing wave ratio. On your next transmission, tell us, what is the brand name of your fan dipole? And does the manufacturer give you any information by which you could find out what should the resonant frequency of the trap be if you had a grid dip meter? Now let me drop. With your antenna analyzer, once you study the schematic, once you study the operating manual, the owner's manual on the antenna analyzer, it'll tell you not only what is the magnitude of the standing wave ratio, the 11.7 you're measuring, but it's nice to know that the 11.7 consists of, let me pick a number, it should be a 50 ohm resistor and 0 ohms of capacitance, so to speak. If it's giving you an answer of 21 ohms of resistance and 150 ohms of inductive reactance, I mean, properly used, the antenna analyzer will tell you the exact number of resistor and reactor that you measure in the shack. Once you know the number of feet of the transmission line, there's a way you can take that shack measurement. If in the shack you measure 20 ohms of resistance and 130 ohms of inductive reactance, if that's what the antenna analyzer is telling you, and then you know that the transmission line is 97 feet long, and you use the right Smith chart or an equation, you can then figure out what impedance at the antenna after 97 feet of coax would give you that reaction in the shack. The craziness about a transmission line is what crazy impedance you put at one end. After X number of wavelengths of a transmission line, you get some other impedance in the shack. It's not random. It's predictable. It's deterministic. But if you know the real numbers in the shack, and you know the number of feet of transmission line, that tells you exactly what impedance you're getting at the antenna. Wonder if that makes some sense, Steve. KD2 HUC, K2LIW in the tech cast.
Okay, I can go with that. I can tell you right now, at 375, I'm getting a resistive component of 7 and a reactive component of about 27. And total impedance, according to the meter, well, hold on, let me let it drop for a second.
By the way, that 27, we want to know, is it plus or minus 27? Is it capacitive 27 or inductive 27? Over to you, Steve.
Dick, because this piece of equipment doesn't provide a signed reactive component. So unless there's another mode for this device, it's an MFJ 259C, which, like I said, I'm not very familiar with this piece of equipment. I really can't tell you whether it's capacitive or inductive. Back to you.
Yeah, by the way, 7 ohms of resistance, of course, is a ridiculous number. That all by itself would give you, an 8-to-1 standing wave ratio if there was no reactance at all. And the reactance, just any amount of reactance aggravates it. Now, even though they don't tell you whether or not the reactance is plus or minus, even if they don't tell you if it's capacitive or inductive, I'll bet you if you study the manual, there's a way of getting that. But if at worst they don't give you that, there's a way that you can derive it by going slightly higher or slightly lower in frequency. Does the reactive component increase or decrease? That'll give you a clue as to whether or not it was inductive or reactive. So you'll get a clue from that, if you know what I mean. But that's a ridiculous resistance. They're telling me something is dead wrong. That something in that antenna is a short circuit or an open circuit on 80 meters. It should be to get it that bad. That's not just an altitude problem. That's not just a tilt problem. Out of curiosity, your tips of your inverted V, how close do they come to the ground? And they're not pressed up against the aluminum siding of the house, are they, Steve? KC2HUC, K2RIW, the TechNet.
WB2HWW6. I think I see the problem already.
I did not allow them to come near the house. I have Dacron rope making it the rest of the way towards the house. So I shouldn't be coupling to anything on the house, or, you know, gutters or anything like that. In answer to your other question, it seems as I increase in frequency, the reactive component goes down. So what is that telling me?
Okay, the fact that it goes down with an increase in frequency suggests that it's inductive. Most inductive reactants, oh wait a minute, I got it backwards. Capacitor reactants usually goes down when you increase in frequency. And how fast it goes down is another clue. One other thing, the tips of your inverted V, how close do they come to the ground, Steve? Go ahead.
Between 15 and 20 feet above the ground.
More than enough. That's not it. So the altitude of the antenna, that's a red herring. The tips coming close to the ground, that's a red herring. Supported with the nylon rope and whatever, and not close to the aluminum siding of the house. Now, you didn't make the error. There's something dead wrong electrically with the antenna now. Howie thinks he's got a guess as to what's going on. Let's see what he's got to say. So the B2HWW, what's your analysis, Howie, K2RIW?
Okay, Dick, this is a fan dipole. You can't make, I don't think you can run a fan dipole in an inverted format because, okay, the lower frequency antenna is usually the highest piece of wire. So you have two, you have an 80, 40 meter with the traps. Then when he says a fan dipole, then I assume he had 20, 15, and 10, or 20 and 10. So if you have, if you make the thing as an inverted Z, what's going to happen, Dick, is the upper wires are going to come closer to the other wires, and that's going to confuse the hell out of that antenna system. A fan dipole, really, you've got to just stretch it out like a regular dipole. Yeah, the higher frequency things will be going like an inverted B, but the lowest frequency ones will be stretched out like a dipole bit. Does that make sense to you? I don't know if I'm explaining it correctly.
Yeah, Howie and I have a fairly strong difference of opinion on this one, Steve. In the case of the shorter elements, the 10-meter, 15, and 20-meter elements, they're much shorter physically. They are so short electronically at 80 meters that no matter where they are, I don't care if you tie a knot in those. I don't care if you tilt them closer to the ground and bend them at a 90-degree angle. They are so far away from resonance on 80 meters, they cannot be a significant impact on the 80-meter portion of the antenna. That's my belief. I know Howie has a slightly different opinion on this one. So I think that's also a red herring. If you had a grid dip meter and you could measure the two traps, even if the manufacturer doesn't tell you what the resonant frequency is, the fact that you can measure the traps with a grid dip meter, do they both dip at the same frequency? If one of them is drastically different, that tells you the capacitor has failed in one of them, if you know what I mean. They better be identical. So that would be a clue. So the traps could have a failure that a visual inspection will not show you, like the capacitor doing something really crazy. There may be a way also of measuring the capacitor. If the capacitor has a label on it telling you it's supposed to be 27 picofarad, and you disconnect one end of the capacitor and put it on a meter that measures capacitance, instead of measuring 27 picofarads, you measure 1 picofarad. You'd say, aha, I've got it. So right now, if you've got good visual inspection at the feed point and good visual inspection of the all the other interconnections to the traps and whatever, then it's time to stop making electrical measurements.
Repeater, time out.
On your next transmission, tell me the total number of feet of transmission line. Is it RG213, RG8U coax cable, and 67 feet long? By way of the length of the transmission line, we can convert the 7 ohms of resistance and 27 ohms of reactance. We can figure out what it is at the other end, and that'll give us another clue. So it sure would be nice if you had a good dip meter and you could measure each of those traps. Steve, any way you get a hold of one of those, that's one way of electrically measuring it. Or, as I said earlier, if you've got some kind of a capacitance measuring meter, and it'd be nice to have a real handheld digital voltmeter that can measure capacitance. Quite a few of them will do that. If you open up one end of the capacitor and measure the capacitance of the circuit, even though one end is connected to the circuit. And there's ways with a grid dip, with a digital voltmeter, you can measure capacitance even though it's not intended to, but that's a little bit more difficult. Over to you for any information on all of the above, Steve. KD2HUC, K2IW in the TechNet.
Comment. I don't remember seeing a capacitor across those coils. Maybe they hide them inside the core, but I didn't see one on either one. So that may be problem number one. I'll have to look into that. As far as the transmission line, it's about 230 feet of RG213. And as a matter of fact, for an experiment, just to see if it made a difference, which it did not, I also have a run of half-inch hardline for VHF, and I just, kind of patched that over for the underground section just to see if it would help improve. Didn't make a difference. It's not a cable issue. It's not an issue with the, with any of the terminations or anything, because like I said, I swapped it over and there was no improvement. So it's definitely got to be something with the antenna. And there was one other question that I wanted to ask, and I can't remember what it was. But I'll give it back to you, and then if it comes to me, I'll ask it.
Come on.
Yeah, you'll think of it. There was a person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Give us your full call letters and name, and then go right ahead with your comment.
K2GJE.
USHO, John and Mount Laurel. I was just going to comment maybe on the same thing that he said. I believe he's talking about an Alpha Delta antenna. I have missed it if the model number was mentioned. But they do not have a capacitor. It's just a coil. Please tell us the model number, the naked model. KC2, FHO, John.
Yeah. Steve, what is the brand name and model number of the antenna? Over to you, Steve.
It is an Alpha Delta, and it is a DXCC.
Okay. There are designs of antennas with...
There is no capacitor.
Okay, John tells us there is no capacitor. So there are brands of antennas where the trap is nothing but a coil. And as such, there's nothing that can go wrong with the coil other than act like an open circuit, and, a cold solder joint, even though it looks good, and you could measure that with an ohmmeter. So now it's becoming more suspicious. K2GJE, I think he wanted to make a comment. Go right ahead, sir. K2LAW.
K2GJE, he said this antenna always was bad on, 7580. He seemed to mention that as he went up in frequency, the SWR got better, but only slightly better. It seems to indicate that the 80-meter portion of this trapped dipole is not long enough. Even if he just put temporarily some wire on each side of it, to see what that does to the SWR, over.
Yeah, I can see where you're going with that one, Ed. But if the wire was a little bit too short for some reason, and if on 80 meters on 3750, which I think is what he said, 3750, he measured a 2-to-1 instead of a 1.4, I'd agree with you. 11.7 and a resistive component of 7 ohms. Something is dead wrong. That's not just a length wrong. If the wire is supposed to be 97 feet long and somebody chopped it off so it's 47 feet long, yeah, you're going to get a visual like that. But to be a couple of feet short, no, I can't suddenly give you 11.7. There's something dead wrong here. One of those coils is an open circuit. One of the leads to the transmission line that feeds it, it's got an open circuit, but even that wouldn't fit. An open circuit at the feed point wouldn't fit because it would be wrong on the other bands at the same time. The fact that he's getting reasonable response on the other bands, and even on 40 meters, tells me something is dead wrong. So I'm tempted to look up the Alpha Delta DXCC antenna to see what the thing looks like. What's the approximate total length of that fan dipole, Steve? And maybe by now you've thought of your other question. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Please input.
WB2HWW.
I think it's 67 feet, Dick. It may be longer. Off the top of my head, I don't remember. But I'll look it up.
Okay, that's close enough. You'd like a dipole in 80 meters to be 132 feet long. And they've made it 67 feet long. Huh. That's almost exactly a half wavelength at 40 meters. At 40 meters, it would be roughly 67 feet long. And you're getting good response on 40 meters. But those, the chokes, the coils, the traps, are supposed to make it work on 80 meters. You can make a dipole 80 meters, as short as 20 feet, if you've got a big enough loading coil on it. Electronically, the physical length of the antenna, to some degree, doesn't matter, as long as you can force it into resonance at your favorite frequency by using loading coils, traps, top hat capacitors on the end, zigzagging the wire, helical winding the wire, and whatever. There's somebody who said he's got another suggestion. Now, who is that person? Give me your full set of call letters and your name, and then your information, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
It's George, KD2FIU. Can I come in, please?
Yeah? We're going to let you come in, George. Go right ahead with your information.
Just cobbled, hand-made, one of these antennas of this design recently, about 10 days ago. All right, what you're looking at is you have a 40-meter. 40 meter is going to be extended in length. It's got a approximately 100 to 120 microhenry inductor coil at the end with a tail. And I'll come back with the reference of design, but both Alpha Delta and MFJ make kind of antennas like this, but it's let me recycle this. My information from a 1963 manual written by J.A. Stanley, who was referencing W4JRW, William Latin, who played with a lot of antennas in the 1950s. And he came up with the formula for this specifically, very specifically, and I followed it, and it's very successful. And you have an extended 40-meter dipole. You've got somewhere around 34 feet plus a few inches for each of the 40-meter ends. You add the 100 to 120 microhenry loading coils to that, and then you build and extend 4 feet plus as a radiating tail to that. Let me recycle. Reference to this design is Latin himself, W4JRW, with a 1961 QST, and he's got one in 1959, which he alludes to it without the design. There are later people who have worked on this, but I got mine originally at a J.A. Stanley 1963 ham radio antenna book. The design is tried and true, and these few companies have made it and actually put their names and trademark to it.